Today, Thursday, April 30th, dawned cold and rainy. Ah, unhappy forecast for Saturday when the 3,000 Democratic ladies will converge upon us on, hopefully, the White House lawn. The papers were full of Lucy. Everything's in apple pie order for Lucy. Three pictures of her at the festival in Winchester. I love the line that said, starry-eyed and thrilled at her first experience as royalty. Lucy arrived 5 minutes ahead of schedule. Oh, surprise for me. This morning at the imposing white column brick home of State Senator Harry Byrd. The first big event of the day was the Congressional Club's annual breakfast honoring the First Lady. How often I have attended it from the other side of the fence. This time, dear Carrie Davis is president. Was a reception beforehand for the wives of the Supreme Court justices. Nearly all of them were there, headed by Mrs. Earl Warren. For the 7 cabinet members who came, and for all the officers of the club. Ruth Burleson is chairman of the breakfast committee this year, with help from Mrs. George Andrews of Alabama. And Betty Kuchel is vice president. I imagine that means she'll probably be president next year. There were about 1,000 women in the familiar ballroom of the Sheraton Park. The Red Coat and Marine Band played. The tables were decorated, of all things, with blue bonnets. I just wish the light hadn't been so bright in my eyes as I walked down the aisle, because on each side there were so many people I wanted to greet. But I was pinpointed like an insect in the brilliant glare of that spotlight as the uniformed aide escorted me down to the head table. I wore my white Alaskan suit with the toast-colored, draped, silkish hat. Carrie was her usual easy self, so capable, so much at home, so devoid of any pomposity in presiding. At the end of the luncheon, she introduced me, and my 2 or 3 lines went something like this. Coming here is familiar territory to me, a little like coming to a family reunion. I remember my first congressional breakfast in 1938, when your guest of honor was Eleanor Roosevelt. And since then, I've been back every time with a constituent. That most important word in our vocabulary. And then thanks, and pointing out the blue bonnets. And on my way out, Barbara Noakes arose in front of me with a bouquet of real blue bonnets flown up from Waco. The entertainment with Risa Stevens singing had been just marvelous. What I missed was some contact, one moment, with all the many, many women of the House and Senate I knew out there in front of me. I'd done it so many times myself, I knew how pleased they were to be there and how carefully they had used their tickets for very special kinfolks or constituents. When I got back to the White House, I heard the happy news that Lyndon had driven down to Winchester to be present at the crowning of Lucy Baines, and later on, I saw the picture of him standing on the steps of the high school while Curtis LeMay crowned Lucy, beaming. Lyndon is tall and straight, as he usually is when he's listening to the national anthem in an airport, but this time, smiling so sweetly. Once more, he's gone that extra mile for one of us. He said, she's always been a queen to me. Everybody had been wondering all along if he'd come. I hadn't. I didn't think it was possible that he would, and I hadn't urged him to. I was amused when Lucy had been asked if she'd ever been a queen before. And she said, no, I've never been anything before. It's rained all the time and been cold, and I wondered if Lucy would come back with pneumonia. Imagine walking through an apple orchard at 9 o'clock in the morning in a sheer organza evening dress and about 50 degrees temperature misting rain. I've been delighted to read that she's posed willingly for the many photographers, has gone from event to event, a women's horticultural luncheon with a sweet word to say, a tea dance at the home of the Richard Byrds, an appearance at a fireman's parade, dinner at the home of the Frank Armstrongs, an appearance at a teenager's dance, and finally, the Queen's Ball in the George Washington Hotel. By now, she knows there's lots of work and some responsibility in being a queen. and I'm beaming to know that she's done it well.
Lyndon's
wire to the officials of the Apple Blossom Festival was really a classic. It began, "To all the people of Virginia, intelligence reports indicate the city of Winchester is in danger of being taken over by a new monarch. I urge all citizens to be on the alert. I have known this ruler all her life. She entered the world with a commanding voice and has been taking over ever since. Beware of her bewitching smile. Underneath that kid glove is a strong hand. Past experience indicates the best way to deal with her is with total attention and love. Signed, Lyndon B. Johnson." Well, so much for royalty. At 3 o'clock, I had a talk with Clara Clifford about the agenda for the meeting on May 7th of the Committee for the Preservation of the White House, and especially about how much money we could expect from the White House Historical Association. He asked me if I would feel good if he came to the meeting, and though he would be an ex officio member, I happily accepted. Then I went down to the movie theater where the staff's having a party for Edith Reilly, who's been with the White House for 30 or more years, back into the Roosevelt days. Now she's leaving, and this was just a little happy goodbye, and say we'll be calling on you whenever we want to know what do you do if so-and-so and so-and-so happens, and how was it done in the past. That's another of the thoughtful things that Liz and Bess concoct. And then the next event of the day was a reception in the Blue Room for the Japanese governors and their wives, something the State Department had asked me to do, and thereby relieve Lyndon of doing. The 11 governors with unpronounceable names were accompanied by their wives in exquisite native costumes with the enormous sashes. Angie Duke and Mrs. George Ball represented the State Department. These exchange visits are sponsored by the Governors Conference, jointly with the National Governors Association of Japan and the State Department. Tall, several times governor of Delaware, Elbert Carvel, who'd made several trips to Japan, was their host from the governor's side of it. After greeting them, we went into the state dining room, and I passed from group to group, bringing out my small store of identification with the Japanese. That in my international group, there had been a very attractive Japanese lady, number two in their embassy, and at one of the meetings she'd shown us a wonderful movie of the silk industry in Japan, and later another member had given us a lesson in that traditional art of flower arranging. Several of the men spoke English, but not a one of the women, I believe. Later, Lyndon and I and Jack sat down to dinner, and then, about 9:30, returned to the Sheraton Park. What a busy place that is, where he spoke to the Democratic Women's Conference. There were some 3,000 women in the hall, and it took us almost 5 minutes to walk to the platform. It was rather like a convention scene with many banners. It seemed to me there was an enormous contingent from Georgia and from North Carolina. When we finally got to the stand, there among the old reliables were Dorothy Redenberg Bush of Alabama, Dr. Tenasek of Maryland, Doña Felisa from Puerto Rico, unmistakable in a crowd, and Hilda Wynott of Texas. Margaret Price introduced Lyndon, and he talked to them, at first jokingly and then seriously, about women in government jobs, ending with, "I promise this not because you need jobs, but because your country needs you," and accenting the administration programs which are of the most concern to women. Three especially, the unemployed and the underpaid, those threatened by disease and disability, and the millions now trapped in hopeless poverty. Thank goodness all I had to do was take a bow,